Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What makes writing such a powerful force in our lives, and does its impact change along with the technology we use to contain and express ideas? Andrei Codrescu writes poetry, novels, essays, and screenplays, and he is a frequent contributor of commentaries to NPR. He found his identity as a writer when he was still a teenager in Romania, exploring his proto-dissident ideas in the first of many notebooks made all the more precious by living in a society where the government tried to dictate what was appropriate for its citizens to read. He shares his own story and contemplates larger questions about the ways we record, preserve, and revisit our social and literary history in his new book, Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. He's in town to appear tonight at 7 at a Word Space event at the Kessler in Dallas. Andrei, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Obviously, it doesn't happen this way for everyone, but it seems like there is no way to make a young person starve for literature like telling him what he cannot read.
That's exactly right. I mean, it was my way of not going to class, not learning what I was supposed to learn, and reading what I wanted to read, especially books that are forbidden in Romania in the 60s, and there are quite a few of them on the index. So I had a good excuse to hang out in the coffee house across from the high school and smoke cigarettes and look darkly at my teachers as they went by. Of course, it was myopia. We didn't know about glasses.
Did you, and you collected books on your own, some of which had been banned, and you sort of kept them very carefully behind glass?
Well, I did. And as it turns out, when I went back in 1989 to cover the so-called collapse, so-called revolution in Romania, one of my high school friends proudly showed me my books on a bookshelf, and he said, "I've had your books all along," and his wife laughed, and she said, "Yeah, right behind the other ones." So people did hide what they were reading. But when I was growing up, it was the end of the Stalinist era, and socialist realism was just beginning to dissolve as a theory, as a way for writers to as a way as writers had to write their works. And so there was a bit of a thaw. So some older people who had libraries lent us young, hungry minds books.
When you got your hands on something that was banned, was it instantly apparent why you weren't supposed to be reading it?
Well, it was to us. There are certain things that the official ideology didn't agree with. Mysticism, which was contrary to dialectical Marxism. Any sort of pre-World War II ideas that didn't sit well with the new order. Certain writers were banished because they had gone into exile. They were living abroad, and they were forbidden for that reason. And some were probably just whims of the censors. And, of course, avant-garde literature, experimental literature, things that didn't tell stories about the so-called real people. And Romania has an old and good tradition of avant-garde writers, beginning with Tristan Tzara, the founder of Dadaism, and a whole a slew of movements that made modern art what it is. And so it was really forbidding a real source of cultural inspiration for Europe.
So what made you decide to start writing? And maybe you can tell us about the first journal that you got, that you started working on.
I loved the poets, and I started memorizing. We had an old, it was also the old Austro-Hungarian system of schooling where you memorized poems, and I memorized a number of lines, and then I was doing my own and thinking about it, but then I realized that the real poets also wrote what they thought about what they were writing, and I was trying to figure out what it was that I could do that was interesting. And so I kept a notebook where I wrote about the poetry that was in there, and I wrote my poems in hand, and I wrote about what I thought about it, and then I decided I would just write everything, and you know, I should just make sure it didn't fall into the wrong hands. Mm-hmm. because I thought it was slightly dangerous, or at least I wanted to think that because it made me a more menacing and mysterious figure.
I mean, how – and you joined a writer's group, is that right? And this is partially a funny story, but can you talk about the sort of officially sanctioned writer's group in your town?
Well, in 1963 in Romania, I had a Wednesday night workshop that met in the Baroque building that it used to belong to Baron von Brukenthal, the governor of Transylvania, and was now the Central Communist Party headquarters. And writers met there, and there were all kinds of people. There was a lawyer from town, and there were a couple of kids like myself who wrote poetry, and a number of provincials, and they wrote all kinds of things. They wrote nature poems, and there was a guy who was writing an endless epic about the struggle of the peasantry throughout the ages, until they achieved the glorious zero of socialism.
So that's going to win points, obviously.
Yeah, he was the most boring guy. Probably he ranks there with the three of the most boring guys. And of course, he read every week. So we read, and then there was a period of criticism. Mm-hmm. So you raised your hand, and you said what you thought about it. But it was obligatory in all of this to say a few words about how the working class was doing very well and winning the fight against imperialism and meeting the five-year plan. And then you went on to talk about the literature. This was a kind of form of address, a little like the dedication to...
Let me interrupt you there, because it sounds like, I mean, you know, Americans always imagine that everybody sort of fell under the spell of this thing. But it sounds from what you've written that people all kind of understood that this was just what you had to say, and then you could sort of be your more authentic self.
Up to a point, yeah. I mean, I think everybody understood that it was kitsch. By the time, by 1965, it was just a bad play. Milan Kundera, in his novel The Joke, actually has a very good take on these societies after the early mid-60s. And everyone was pretending. And everyone knew, including the secret police and the bureaucrats of the Communist Party, that they were all part of a farce. And it was a farce that was enforced by the Soviet tanks, so it wasn't that much of a joke. But everything started to be replaced. Folk music was replaced by these folk ensembles, the patriotic music, and poetry was carried this kind of address to the, you know, to the ideology. But it being a farce didn't mean necessarily that you were making good literature, that you were actually doing what you wanted to, or that you experimented. It meant that you're still working within the approved modes, but you had a little more liberty of feeling or of expression, and it was okay to be pessimistic, for instance, in your poems, while the paean and the address to the party was always optimistic because the future of humanity was communism, which was really Walmart.
Yeah.
but that was understood, and so it was possible for your work to contradict your overt opening.
But there were things that you kept to yourself that you would not have brought into that writer's workshop.
Well, for older revolutionary rhetoric, even at the beginning, the communists were extremely puritanical, for one thing. So you couldn't, I mean, there were, and my town being provincial and founded by Saxons in the 13th century had a kind of rigor and piety about it. So what seemed dangerous, and this probably would seem like nothing now, but I wrote down everything I thought, but some of it I wanted it to be decadent and blasphemous and daring, but it in fact was pretty tame looking back, I think, because that notebook was lost. So I never had what I did call in this book the archive of my young mind. I never reread it.
Yeah, it's such an interesting idea that, we know about the vagaries of memory, and it could be very different than what you imagine. And I have to think there must be something in there that you would have no memory of having written that would bring something back to you.
Well, I think that most of what happened I don't know except from my own books. I wrote an autobiography when I was 23 years old, modestly entitled The Life and Times of an Involuntary Genius. And it was a good time to write an autobiography because I didn't, I remembered everything. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any access to Grind. I didn't have any reasons to. I presented myself as a character in the third person, and I was the hero of my own adventure, and I wrote that book. But I remember now things from the book. I don't quite remember them like I did back then. And my mother, who read the book when it first came out, said, well, that's not what happened. And then a year later, she told me the story was, it was from the book. I had changed her little memory cassette. And I said, but you told me it was different. And she said, oh, no. Because she read it in a book.
So do you think that explains our drive to archive everything? If you think about, you know, before we had the ability to read and write, we have lost the majority of human history. And we sort of wonder about what happened, but we're kind of okay without it. But now that we have the ability to put anything into a permanent record, we're afraid of letting anything slip away.
Well, it's a process that began really with printing because we decided we couldn't know everything in the world and remember it, and then we put it in books, and so you could look it up later. Now we can archive everything and forget it all. And so Google is our current memory, and it came just about in time for my generation, I must say. But we can digitize not memory as much as the narratives of memory, the stories that we tell about what happened. And so the ones that are best told are the ones that are going to be best remembered because they'll be the ones who will be best preserved. And so what actually happened or didn't happen is something that will be part of these amnesia archive, you know, this unarchive. Hmm. Where most things take place, as a matter of fact, because all the things we articulate and the things that we think we remember are, in fact, just the things that we can make into complete sentences.
And even when we have a written record in any medium, whether it's digital or in paper and ink, it's still a sort of artificial representation of human thought and experience.
Yeah, it's a virtual world. That's why I don't think that it... the change from movable type, from the Gutenberg type of in the book to the electronic format is changes anything because the contents get transferred. As I call it here, it's a transference without the metaphysics. It just the content will be there, but there is something still that makes the book. An experience that we will in time forget, which is the actual gritty nature of the book that was once read and felt and sweated on and, you know, contained various traces of the human body.
My guest is Andre Codrescu. He is a poet, novelist, essayist, and screenwriter, also a frequent contributor of commentaries to NPR. His new book is called Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. He's in town to appear tonight at 7 at a Word Space event at the Kessler Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Andrei Codrescu. You may be familiar with his commentaries on NPR. His new book is called Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. He's in town to appear tonight at a WordSpace event at 7 at the Kessler Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. You were talking before the break, Andrei, about the sort of traces of human life that can be left on paper text. Can you talk, this is sort of an extreme case, but about the papers archived of Richard Brautigan's?
Well, I was writing this book and I needed something better than my own opinions. And J.J. Phillips, former archivist at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, who had worked with Richard Brautigan's papers, wrote to me a very timely letter about working with those papers and how there were actual traces of his brain on the papers, because Brautigan committed suicide and blew his brains out on his last manuscript. And she thought that this should be somehow noted and displayed and talked about by Bancroft. Instead, she got an awful lot of resistance to that idea. People didn't like they didn't know how to present something so visceral. But for me, it was an important argument in this idea that a book read contains something of the body of the reader. And, in extremis, you can actually recreate the reader, a very rare creature these days, by cloning the DNA on the book. But, I have personally a kind of an allergy to books that have been read, to used books, although I love them and I will read them if I can find them in any other way. But that's just because I do feel that there was someone else present there before. And I kind of transferred that to the Kindle because I don't like readers' comments in the Kindle, mm-hmm. which they share, and I hate to see underlined passages because I want to make up my own mind about them. I don't really care what somebody else read it.
I had to turn that off too because I found it. I wondered why did you highlight this, and then I just had to turn that feature off. Yeah. Talk about this. When you were a child in a society where the government dictated what could and could not be read, libraries were still treated as these sacred places. Books were treated as sacred objects, but it was the objects themselves that seemed to be more important than the ideas within.
Our town is very old. Sibiu, Hermannstadt was it's a 1,500-year-old city, and it had an old library in it. They were very proud of the Astra Library, and it had various incunabula and manuscripts from hand-illuminated manuscripts from before Gutenberg. And they were all mostly on religious subjects and about the Bible. And one of the field trips that my class took was to the Astra Library so we could look at these wonderful old treasures, which were chained to a lectern and held in place by various restraints, and the librarian, after making sure that we wouldn't touch them, at our hands or at our sides, would turn the pages and show us the illustrations and the books. But they were in Latin, and of course the contents didn't matter. It was the object that was being worshipped. But there was one book there that has had a profound influence because the binding contained a page from a manuscript of Tristan and Isolde from for the 14th century. The page had disappeared a long time before, but the letters remained impressed in the leather. Mm-hmm. And it provided me, even though I didn't think about it at the time, but it was a kind of a metaphor for what a writer eventually will do and what will remain of what the writer does, which are these traces that may not even be the original paper, but something left behind by the process of gluing or binding.
So even after maybe we've forgotten the experience of reading a particular text, it can't help but change us in some way.
I think these things keep an independent life and they work independently. And this is one reason why this book for me. I'm getting to be a kid again and writing what I want. And if I write something, and then I'll think, yes, but you could also say something else, then the footnote to that thought becomes its own story. So some of these footnotes are actually those images and events that work their way subconsciously until I let them out. One tends to write things that can be seen in the daylight, and so you... But then you have these other thoughts simultaneously, and it's hard to know what to do with them. So one way to deal with them is to create another book in the footnotes. And so I'm writing two. These are two books in one.
Yeah, we should explain this to people, because I think ordinarily when people hear very extensive footnotes, they sort of run the other way. But it is sort of two parallel stories. And I thought it was really interesting, one, because I had not seen a book done this way before. And two, because it is a reminder that everything that gets written is a process of sort of real life and the undercurrents of the other ideas that you're having as you're trying to put together a cohesive narrative. I suppose you could have gone, I mean, it's almost like a house of mirrors, right? A hall of mirrors. Mm-hmm. You could have done this until you couldn't stop. I mean, was there a point at which you had to say, all right, I'm just going to follow these two threads?
Well, many writers have, in one way or another, stumbled on this. David Foster Wallace uses extensive footnotes, mainly of a psychological or psychotherapeutic nature, to gloss his main texts. And, of course, Vladimir Nabokov played with it wonderfully in Pale Fire, which is a footnoted gloss on a single poem. So the literary device is there. I read Richard Burton translation of the 1001 Nights, which was published as a private edition with extensive footnotes by Burton, who was an Arabist and an adventurer, and he had lived in all kinds of places. And his footnotes are just spectacularly delicious, because he does exactly that. He translates and then tells you where he was and what he was doing. And I wrote a book on the 1001 Nights using the Burton translations and some other translations of the 1001 Nights, and it's called Whatever Gets You Through the Night, A Story of Scheherazade and the Arabian Entertainment. And that's what happens there. I decided that I would tell one story from the 1001 Nights, which many novelists have done, from Balzac onwards. Everybody ripped off the 1001 Nights. And tell one story, and then tell the story of the translators and of all the scholarship and mythology surrounding the 1001 Nights. And it was so much fun, and I thought I discovered something there. So in this book, actually, there was a method in the form. So I stopped when I had to. I mean, I knew. I mean, sometimes there was another book in the making, so I wasn't going to do that.
How many languages do you speak?
Oh, me, just four.
Well.
Well, I know a guy who speaks 54, so.
Do you write in all four?
No, I tried. I write in Romanian again, because after I went back with NPR in 1989 to cover the so-called revolution.
Why do you keep saying so-called revolution?
I have to put quotes around it, because it was really sort of a coup d'etat with some mass demonstrations. Romanians have a wonderful word for it. It's called lovilutia, which is actually a combination of coup d'etat and revolution. Can't do it in other languages. But when I went back, I wasn't speaking Romanian anymore. And then I started to pick it up, and they started translating my books, and I've been back every year. And then I wrote a collaborative poem with a poet from Cluj, Ruxandra Cesaranu, by email. And I wrote it in Romanian. And in fact, I became so interested in what we're doing, writing it, that I forgot I was writing in Romanian. So I realized at some point that I was actually back. So I was truly bilingual again.
Do you feel like your voice is the same in either language?
No, no, not at all. In fact, I translated our poem into English. It came out, it's called The Forgiven Submarine. It was published by Black Widow Press. And the hardest part was translating my own stuff back into English.
Really?
Her sections were fine. Mm-hmm. I could deal with those, but my own was something else.
too much attachment to them or too much sense of why it sort of only worked in the first language?
Right. Yeah. It only works in Romanian. And so that's, in fact, the reason why they are so interesting is because they couldn't be said in English.
Yeah, I think that idea of sort of the attachment of language to identity is really interesting because you're the same person with the same experiences. But as everyone who speaks multiple language knows, and as you just illustrated with the term for the revolution that's used in Romania, there are you can get your way around any concept, but there are sort of elegant phrases in particular languages that don't translate.
Well, part of that is history, of course. You know, Romanians had a particularly unfortunate history being squeezed between about two or three empires, and so they developed quite a language for dealing with officials on the one hand and with their friends on the other. So they could say things that sounded exactly the same, but their friends would understand one thing and the policeman another. And so there is that kind of language. It's a bit of the sort of reversal, ghetto reversal of the English in where bad is good. And but there was that. And in other ways, you know, I think the language, because it is sound, it changes your physiognomy. I mean, you know, you literally have to open your mouth in a different way to speak Romanian, a language that's heavier on vowels or on consonants will make you move differently and will make your face different. Mm-hmm. I mean, why do the French look French? It's because they talk French.
Well, and as a poet, I would imagine that that is something that is always on your mind because it's not only the sound of the word in your ears, but it's the way the words look on the page.
Well, there is that, and they do look different. If you look at a text in a language you don't speak in or the Chinese or an Arabic text, you'd get a completely different vision of the graphic and imagine, if you like, translate imaginatively without knowing the language, something else. One of the exercises I like to give my students when I was teaching was to translate from a language they didn't know and just listen to the sound and look at the page and translate, quote unquote.
So you were in Sweden last week at a signing for a book that you wrote previously that's just been translated. I mean, when you consider that text, do you think having been translated by someone other than you into Swedish, is it something less than, something other than exactly what you wrote? Or what's your relationship to what that work is now?
Well, that's an excellent question because I don't speak Swedish. So I can drive my Romanian translators crazy because I speak the language. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea what's in the Swedish. And I can't really tell from the questions that people asked, except that the Swedes are cognizant of the history that I treat about in this book, which is a book about the Dada movement. It's called The Post-Human Dada Guide, Tsara and Lenin Play Chess. So it is about the history of a European avant-garde and ideology born partly in Sweden, because Lenin was in two Swedish exiles. Actually, my host there took me directly to the Royal Library in Stockholm, where Lenin's table is, where he studied both in 1907 and 1910, when he signed himself under different pseudonyms. There's a kind of mythology of Lenin in Stockholm that's kind of like George Washington slept here. And during the heydays of the Soviets, workers were rewarded for their labor with a trip to Sweden to deposit a flower on Lenin's oak table. and a 30-hour trip by bus from the Kremlin, or they put more flowers on it. So, you know, they do know, they have this history. So my book, in some way, was familiar to them. So I imagine that they read it a bit differently.
Yeah, I'm always interested to hear about translations of Shakespeare into every other language. And you can look at Shakespeare for the amazing stories and the characters, but he was obviously so obsessed with language and with wordplay that I always wonder how well it really works in another language.
That is really good, too, a good question, because there are certain genius translations of Shakespeare. The great American Finnish poet Anselm Hallow, his father was the translator of Shakespeare into Finnish. And it's generally thought to be a translation of genius. And there are a few others. Ștefan Augustin Doinașer, great Romanian poet, translated Shakespeare into Romanian. And again, he had to reinvent the language. So these people are very rare. They're a bit like presidential biographers. I mean, there aren't that many of them.
And there, I would imagine translators don't, outside the literary community, maybe don't get the respect they deserve. People assume if you're really good in two languages, you can knock out a translation.
Well, no. It's the great translators are few and rare between. The great translator Michael Henry Haim, who died not long ago, was translated Milan Kundera and Hrabal, the Czech writer, into English. And he's really changed our view of the world in some way through his translations. I mean, of course, the writer's ideas were the ones that did the main job. The translation is really stuck.
We have an email here from Steve who asks, what advice do you have for a frustrated writer who feels he has a story to tell but is not confident in his training to write?
Give it up.
Really?
I don't know. You know, I've taught literature for quite a time, you know, and it's easy enough to teach how to write novels and poems. What's not easy to do is really get it out the way you want to. And I think that the purpose of teaching is to teach you how to write in a certain way that doesn't get out what you really want to say, is to fake it. And yeah, he can fake it, or he can give it up, or he can actually think that it can be done and just do it.
I guess the other thing you can't teach is the persistence it takes to keep going when you're not sure whether you're really doing it or whether you're faking it.
Yeah, there is that. And then there's always suicide.
My guest is Andrei Codrescu. He is a poet, novelist, essayist, and screenwriter. He's also a frequent contributor of commentaries to NPR. His new book is called Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. He's in town to appear tonight at a WordSpace event at the Kessler in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Andrei Codrescu. You may know him as a frequent contributor of commentaries to NPR or from his poetry, novels, essays, and screenplays. His new book is called Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. He'll appear tonight at 7 at a WordSpace event at the Kessler Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So you've written about the fact, Andrei, that as more and more of our literature is available in a digital copy, we've always been upset when texts we consider sacred are destroyed as physical objects, but no one is bothered by the fact that you sort of delete the Bible or the Quran from your Kindle.
That's right. We haven't had any mass demonstrations about the removal of electronic sacred texts from libraries. I think part of the idea of considering the writing a sacramental or scriptural act, you know, has disappeared from Western societies, and it still remains here and there in the world, where people think that their language is sacred and desecrated in any way, like writing it on shoes is something to go out and demonstrate about. What the electronic medium has done is really to allow people to read what they want to, because I've noticed on airplanes that people used to hold quite impressive books in their hand to partly opposed to see that they were serious people and they were reading interesting books or the latest book.
So your seatmate doesn't see you reading 50 Shades of Grey.
Exactly. Yeah. So now you can read that on Kindle and absolutely nobody has any idea what you're reading. So I think about half of the great modern literature disappeared in the new format.
Well, I mean, it is interesting. I've always been fascinated by people who are rare book collectors. When I learned that most of them wouldn't dare obtain a really valuable text and then do something so pedestrian as to open it up and read it.
I know those people. I worked in one of the last great literate bookstores in New York when I first came here at the 8th Street bookstore on 8th Street. And between 2nd and 3rd Avenues, and it was a writer's bookstore. And people came to read, and came to buy books. The great writers all had charge accounts, and the clerks are all writers, and we gave people terrible looks if they bought books they didn't consider wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a completely different atmosphere than the friendlier scene that came after in Barnes & Noble where you could have coffee or, read books. What did you ask me?
The idea, that rare book collectors won't read book. And to my mind, it's almost like the book and the text become separate things. They're just not, they're no longer the same thing.
Well, what I was going to say about the 8th Street bookstore is that there was a section upstairs of books that my boss didn't want to sell. And so people would come and he'd say, well, you don't really want this book. And the best book people are ones who actually love their books so much that they really don't want to sell them. And the collectors are just an extreme version of that because they just want to have them.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Terry who writes that Terry's a big fan and says, what about Samuel Beckett, who wrote in French and then translated his own work back into English?
Well, there's an amazing and probably unique case. I mean, he translated into English. He was Irish. He already had that wonderful richness of Irish. He was a contemporary of James Joyce, who was writing the best prose in English around the same time. So, and he is as good in French because he lived in France. And so he was a true bilingual, I think. Beckett, probably, though, if you read carefully the different translations, you'll find that he played games and he did translate certain things differently. I mean, I'm not a Beckett scholar, so I really couldn't tell you, but he didn't translate for publication. He translated because he wanted to see what happens when you go back and forth.
So the other interesting thing to me about the digital conversion of so much writing is that on the one hand, it allows smaller voices without official sanction from a publisher to get their work out there. On the other hand, it becomes harder and harder for anybody to make a living doing this. And you can argue, well, they're doing it because they love it, but not being able to write full time is also an impediment to certain kinds of work.
The pay for writers is gone. Everybody's writing for free. They're writing blogs. And it's true. I met a very rare kind of person in Sweden, a reader. someone who was part of this literary festival who was taking notes to start another festival in a town somewhere north in Sweden. And I asked her if she was a writer, and she said, no, I'm a reader. Very serious. And I thought, I think we should put her in a museum or a frame, because the idea of a pure reader is quite extraordinary. And, you know, I have a great deal of respect for, you know, book clubs. But you know that secretly everyone has a memoir that they are working on. But yes, I think that what you're looking for is readers. And I think instead of paying writers, now we should have readers for pay. And so you should pay readers to read. My last semester of teaching, I was paying $5 or so for every books that I actually read, and also that much for things they didn't write. So I pay $5 for a poem that wasn't written, and $3 for a story that wasn't written, because I think poetry is a more pricey art. And so you had these, you know, on the one hand, you'd pay people to stay away from these attempts at graphomania, and then you also encouraged them to read. I put a whole bunch of wonderful books out on the stoop of my apartment in New Orleans and expecting people to take them. And they just left them. They didn't, you know, they take everything else that sits there, but not books. And so I put a sign and that said $5. And people came by and they said, they looked at the books and they said, this book is not worth $5. I said, you don't understand. I'm paying you $5. So take it. Well, you have to come back and tell me you actually read it.
It is interesting. I mean, I've thought this a lot about the proliferation of blogs, and there's Facebook and there's Twitter, and it seems like a lot of people are putting out a lot of content, and you can argue about whether this is, I mean, I don't know your feeling on this, whether this is real writing or not, but people are expressing a lot about themselves without necessarily feeling obligated to pay attention to what anyone else has to say.
Well, this is a grave. I mean, this is a social problem because people are just talking to other people who think what they think, and so they don't get their news from anyone but their circle, from Facebook or Twitter or whoever they follow. And so it creates a isolated island of agreement. And it leaves the larger problems to I don't know to whom exactly, to Arianna Huffington, who's an aggregator who puts together various blogs and pieces about issues, and she is in fact an editor, just like an editor of a newspaper was at one time, but it's collected from the internet. But it is still she doesn't pay anyone for it. So I think that the incentive to actually do the best in the way of reporting and writing is not there. It is much easier to just opinionate, which is part of the reason I hate doing now commentary for NPR in the past year or so. I kind of stopped because I'm kind of sick of my own opinions, but also because everybody does it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the idea that everyone's out there with opinions somehow devalues any individual one?
Well, no, because I think there's a bit of news. You know, something happens, and then everyone has an opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And then you begin to be lost in the opinion and mistake it for the actual news. So people forget what it was that started this whole discussion in the first place. And news itself is a difficult business because you have to have priorities and you have to know what news is at the top of the lineup and what comes under it and so on and so on. And our culture already has sifted through the idea of news so that certain kinds of news are at the top, and mm-hmm. culture, for instance, and books and so on fall in the category of entertainment, and they just fall right to the bottom of our common interests. And and investigative reporting is something that costs money and that has to be done by people who get paid for it. It's not an easy thing to do. They need time. And that has been going away as well, way before the internet actually had everyone writing. Newspapers are already trying to look like television. Mm-hmm. USA Today was the first one to start this sort of bigger picture and less text. Reporters are given less time, there was less money, people read less, and so on. So I think in a way we are prisoners now. I think the internet has made captives of us in a new way. I think we were before captives to certain editorial trends and fashions and ways of reporting. not to speak of the fact that we are existential prisoners of this body and world, but there was the smaller prison of history, of current history, and now we're in this glass house of the internet where everyone can see everything and where if there are any real secrets, they are easy to hide, not because they're not revealed, but because there's so much stuff out there that you cannot find it, mm-hmm. that the lead is really, really buried.
Do you think there's a new kind of moral hazard? I mean, I suppose there's always been a moral hazard to attaching financial compensation for creating a work of art or a piece of writing. But now that's not there and it's been replaced by the desire for fame, it seems like money is the purest possible way that we can motivate people as compared with simply wanting attention.
Well, fame is also a shifting concept because people are now famous for being famous. They don't particularly have to do anything. Time is a value, and I think the way we reward value and time is with money. And I think that when Norman Mailer was reporting, for instance, writing his sort of verite work, he was getting about $100 a line, so every time he heard that click at the end of his typewriter, he just made another $100. And I mean, that's really an incentive. I don't think quite that way, not because I think, money and art should be separate, but because I now live in the country and I think practically, if I do this, then I can get a new gate mm-hmm. or a new this and that. So, clearly, there was a time when writers were overpriced, a very brief period. Writers of popular novels were paid, but now everything has shifted, so the marketing people really are in charge. So you have very few editors, really. You have meetings between marketing people and editors, and the marketing people tell you if it will go or not. And then there's the third and secret meeting when the house, even if it buys a book, for instance, decides what the priority of the budget for publicity is.
Worth investing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I read somewhere that you had at least considered the idea of writing for children. Is that true?
I wrote some stories from sort of nighttime stories I told my children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think I'm not sure where you heard that, but I think that's a very good idea.
I think it was something you were sort of extolling the virtues of a writer like Dr. Seuss and saying there is value to that.
Well, there's a value, sure, because he could do that thing that really great writers can, which is to be simple and delightful and understood by children and also be profoundly interesting to adults.
Andrei Kordrescu writes poetry, novels, essays, and screenplays, and he contributes commentaries to NPR. His latest book is called Bibliodeath, My Archives with Life in Footnotes. He's in town to appear at a WordSpace event tonight at 7 at the Kessler in Dallas. Andrei, it's been such a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We welcome your comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.